So this week is Parshas Vayetze. Yaakov went out from Beersheba and he went to Charan. Medrash Tanchuma begins Yilamdenu Rabbeinu. This Medrash Tanchuma is also called Medrash Yilamdenu, teach us. And it often begins a sedra with a question, you know, let the rabbi teach us. Ha'horig es ha'nefesh b'shkogo, somebody who kills somebody by accident. Leheichan ho'yegoyla, where did he have to go into exile? And the answer is, Kach Shanu Rabbi Seinu, this is what our Rebbe's told us, Ha'horig nefesh bishkoga, somebody who kills someone by accident, Goyle le'orei miklot, he has to go into exile to one of the cities of refuge, L'sholo she'orem sheba eva hayadin, to one of the three cities of refuge which was in Transjordan, V'sholo sheba it's Canaan, and or one of the three that was in the land of Canaan. V'yakav avinu gola le'choran, and Yaakov avinu, our father Jacob had to go into exile to Choron. Bereach ben Nafshon, he's running away to save his life. Ben Isyore, and he's afraid he shouldn't be killed by his brother, the wicked Esav. Mikevan shiroya kodesh baruchu b'tzora gedoyla, since God sees that Jacob is in great distress, nigla olav b'chaloyim, he reveals himself to him in a dream. Omer Rabavu b'shem Rav Shimon ben Lakish. Rabavu says in the name of Rav Shimon ben Lakish, kiven shera'u hu avonim, since the stones saw, which stones? Shehayu tachas merashoysav, that were underneath Jacob's head when he lay down that night, it says, and he took of the stones of the place and he put them underneath his head. So since they saw kvoidoy shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the glory of God, nimchu kulam, they all melted, v'nasu even achas, and they became one stone. Minayin, how do you know this? Sh'ad shel yishan, until he fell asleep, k'siv, the Torah tells us, v'yikach mei avnei hamokam, he took of the stones of the place. Avonim ha'avim, many stones. Kiven shenin ar, when it woke up, when Jacob woke up in the morning, it says, Vayikach eso evan, and he took the stone. It was one stone. So this is the Medrash that opens this parsha in the Medrash of Rabbi Tanchuma, which is, you know, one of the basic Midrashim that Rashi uses. And most of the Ishbitz, the Meir Shiloach and the Yaakov, is based on this Medrash Yilamdenu, Medrash Tanchuma. And he's one of the reasons it's called Tanchuma is because he usually finishes the Medrash with the words of comfort, even when the subject matter is not comfortable. So the question is, where do we find that Jacob killed anybody, that the Medrash should open like this? What do you do if you kill somebody by accident? And then, you know, leads into the story of Jacob going to Haran. So the implication is that Jacob's gone to Haran because he's going into exile. And it's true that in some senses the very first exile that we find in the Torah is this golus, the exile of Jacob having to run away. And every exile is a kind of a running away from the Belzer Rebbe used to say there are three kinds of golus, three kinds of exile. One is the exile of the Yidden among the Goyim, where we are strangers and we are aliens and we are the other, and we're never comfortable and we're never at home and we are always treated as unwelcome. And then the Belzer Rebbe said there's a worse kind of exile, which is the exile of a person in their own family. Sometimes we turn around and we look at our family and they're strangers, we're strangers to them. And we have to leave just simply because being there is so uncomfortable and it's not our place. The Belzer Rebbe says that the most painful exile is in fact the one of a person inside himself. If you find you feel alien within yourself, then you're truly in exile. But what does Yaakov do? So, in last week's Sedra, says that when Yaakov, Achyus is Yaakov has just left, gone out, after having received the blessings, and his brother Esav comes in, and the Torah tells us, Ve'yechrad Yitzchak charod gedoy l'admoid, Yitzchak starts to tremble with this terrible, terrible fear. And the Medrash says that Isaac's fear is greater than that he anything that he felt when he was father just about to kill him. He's lying on the altar, but he doesn't feel anything compared to this fear that he fears now. What's happened? The Medrash says, what do you mean? Your child leaves the room, another child walks in the room. So you get terrified? So the Medrash says, B'sho'o shenichnas Esav etzel Aviv, at that moment when Esav comes back into the room after Jacob has left, nichnasa imoy Gehenim. Gehenim came in with him. Hell came in with him. And Yitzchak saw that hell had opened up for him and that Esau was stoking it. It's interesting that very same Medrash in Bereishis Rabbah says that all day Esau had spent the day hunting because his father had said to him, Tzudali tzayit, Vaseli matame, make me some delicacies the way I like it, and I'll bring it to me so I'll eat and I'll feel good and I'll bless you. As we were saying last week, his father was really asking him to, you know, take him out of himself and make him a little bit tipsy, intoxicated, so that he could give him the bracha with a whole heart, even knowing who he was. But now Esav comes in, all of a sudden Yitzchak sees hell open up underneath him. And I think, you know, the Gemara in Nedarim says, Kalakoyes Kulmina Gehenim Sholtim, all of that. Whoever gets enraged, he brings down all kinds of hell upon himself. Here in the Medrash, where it says that all day Esau was trying to trap game, as soon as he trapped it, then came an angel and untrapped it, right? So he was hunting the birds, then came an angel and scared all the birds away, and Esav couldn't really trap anything all day. And the Medrash says that was in order so that Yaakov would have time to prepare the dinner for his father and feed it to him and get the blessings before Esau came back. But Esau came back in this terrible rage, and that it was when he came back in a rage that Isaac was able to see just what kind of person Esau was. The question is why he hadn't been able to see that earlier. Obviously Isaac could see who his son was. Isaac was the tzaddik hadar. He was the rebbe of the generation. Obviously he could see, his eyes were open. But until that moment, Isaac thought, and this is a Ishbit Satori we've learned many times, Isaac thought, the truth is, who's a tzaddik and who's a rosh? Who can say? Who can say what person is chosen by God for which purpose? You can't say, you can't know. I mean, the whole Torah that we've been learning every year, again and again, in the Me'a Shiloyach and all the other Torahs that we've been learning, is that B'ritzos Hashem Darkei Ish, that if God has chosen the path for a person, Gam Oivav Yashlim Imoy, then even that worst enemy makes peace. And, you know, it doesn't matter what the kavana, what a person has in mind, God is running the world and is always in charge. And there's no place in any event for the absence of the divine. So the meaning of history, the narrative, is that which God has chosen, and that's the Ishbit Satoira of Hakol Bidei Shamayim, Afilu Yiras Shamayim, everything is from heaven, even the fear of heaven. And nobody knew this like Yitzchak knows this. Yitzchak is the personification of Hakol Bidei Shamayim v'afilu Yiras Shamayim, because Yitzchak Avinu is the one who feels that God is inside him. That's the meaning of being Yitzchak. Avram Avinu, he's the one who brings into the world the awareness of God in the world. Yitzhak Avinu is the one who brings into the world the awareness of God in the self. Yitzhak knows that events in history are given meaning by God, and whatever God's purpose is, that's what the event means, you know. And just because I do something, it doesn't mean that the meaning that it's going to have is that which I intended. My kavana is not what decides. God is always the decider. And that God can take the life of Esau, bad as it is, reckless as it is, cruel and pitiless, heartless, discompassionate, what all the things that Esav is, God can take and turn it around and, you know, make him a Baal Tshuva, or simply take his acts and give them a meaning other than that which he intended. As we see with Yehuda and Tamar, you know, we come back to this almost a pivotal moment in the history of the world where Yehuda is overcome with lust for Tamar, and he thinks she's a prostitute, and then he asks her, you know, how much do you charge, and he negotiates a price for sex, and then he goes and it does, and the Gemara says, you know, Yaakov is busy mourning for Joseph, and Joseph is in prison mourning for himself, and the brothers are mourning this one and that one, as everybody's in mourning, and Isaac is in mourning for Jacob, and Yehuda is getting married, and God is planting the seeds of the light, Oiroi Shel Mashiach, the light of Mashiach. And there in that act that Yehuda would have said that his kavana, his intention, is not anything but a meaningless, if such a thing is possible, a meaningless act of self-gratification, and there is Mashiach is happening in that act. So how would that be different from any of the self-gratifying acts of that Esau does? And maybe you know, the fact that Yehuda is a gentleman, and you know, he leaves his pledge with Tamar, and doesn't, you know, snatch it back and say, I promise I'll pay you, you know, in the meantime, I'm going to take my credit card back. He doesn't do that. And, you know, the Rebbe Rabbunim says the fact that he doesn't do that does something, changes the act afterwards and puts some honesty in it. And he could have by force taken his pledge back and said, you know, look, I promise I'll pay, I'll send the money. But then the story would have ended differently, and she wouldn't have been able to save herself by sending these... the pledge and saying to whoever this belongs, I'm pregnant, and then Mashiach wouldn't have been born from this act and so forth. But the point that I'm making is that when we do things, God can then take that act and, you know, turn it into part of a narrative in that arachnid way, you know, that spinning the web of the narrative. And just by the way, you know, we've said this again many times, that, you know, in the sense of our understanding as human beings of who we are, you know, we are, you know, the scientists say that we're, you know, descended from monkeys, from apes, and so forth, and that the human is some kind of an ape, and that we're very close and genetically, you know, and the truth is, Maybe it's true, but we are, if that's the case, then we are panarans. We are the monkey that tells stories. And the narrative is what it's all about. You know, I mean, there are three things that define us as human beings that mean that we're not a chimpanzee and we're not an ape, is that we were learning in Sefer Yetzirah, b'sfor, b'sefer, b'sipur, that we count, we have numbers, and we make reckonings, and we do mathematics, and in that we're different from the chimpanzee. And Sefer, we write stuff down and we record events, and we are able to teach other people what we have done without having to be there with them, and we can leave a story behind. And Sipur, ultimately we have the story, and we narrate, and everything that we're doing, and we're sitting and we're learning here now, and what we're doing is we're narrating, we're telling a narrative of Yaakov and Esav, and this is really the only thing that we have, and the Torah is a narrative. And the Rishonim used to say, you know, that the amazing thing about us and God is that we have this way of understanding one another and speaking to one another, and the Rabbanu Shalom can give us this whole Ano Nafshoi Kasivus Yehovah, I myself write and give. And what is it, this Torah, this Anoichi, is a story. God is this great storyteller. And our understanding of how, what it means to be human being, is that we are part of a narrative, and that we can describe our whole world in a narrative. And that even we have a picture of God that is built up of this narrative. And Yitzhak knows that God can spin this narrative and make Esav into the tzaddik. And if he does so, then Esav will be greater than Yaakov, because Esav takes such great risks. And wherever a person takes great risks, in the spiritual world as much as in the money world, right? That if I put my money in a very risky place, then I can expect very big rewards. And if I put my money in a very safe place, I can't expect very high rewards. And that's how it is with stocks and bonds and shares and stuff like that. And the same it is with the soul. Right? So if I'm not prepared to take any risks, then I'm never going to grow. And so if God interprets the life of Esav as being one of spiritual risk, then Esav will be very great. So who's going to be Mevarer? Who is going to work through Esav's issues? Who is going to show that Esav, these things that he did, and these experiments that he practiced, and this lifestyle, that it has within everything something holy and something worthwhile, and something that represents the projection of God into the world as this persona that is going to have to come about through Yaakov? Isaac understands that Jacob's purpose in the world is to be Mevare Esav, to make Esav transparent to the divine. Now that Isaac has blessed Jacob, and the Medrash says that when he discovered that he had blessed Jacob, his first reaction was to curse Jacob. And he was just about to curse him when God says to him, wait a minute, you realize that in doing so you'll curse yourself, because one of the things that you promised him was that anybody who curses you will be cursed. You can't do that. But once everything has gone over to Yaakov, then Yaakov is able to say, you know, I'm not going to sit around and wait for Esav forever. Like the Ishbitzer says, when we talk about the destruction of the wicked, sometimes you find that the way that scripture describes this, the destruction of the wicked, is with great joy and simcha, and the downfall and so forth. And sometimes you don't find that, right? Like with Yetzias Mitzrayim, with the Exodus from Egypt, we find that, you know, while we rejoice, the simcha is not complete. And so on Pesach, you know, we only say Hallel, the great Hallel, on the first 2 days, but as Pesach progresses, there's a greater awareness that this is a destruction of the Egyptians, and God is, you know, we don't find, like the Gemara says, when the angels wanted to sing that morning at the by the splitting of the Red Sea, God said, "My children are drowning in the sea, and you want to sing," and so forth. So that day, the angels didn't sing their song, and yet we don't find that during the period when Noach was in the ark and the world was being destroyed by drowning, we don't find that God said to the angels, "Don't sing," because the Ishbitzer says, because when something happens in the right time, like a civilization has risen and it's reached its apogee, and now it's going to fall because it's, you know, passed into its corrupt state, and so forth. And then Benefoil, with the downfall of the wicked, there's a joy to see the wheel of fate, you know, catch up and crush beneath it the iniquity. But with Mitzrayim, the truth is that there was still plenty good in Egypt. And had we had the time and opportunity, we would have stayed in Egypt more, and we would have raised up more of the sparks. And I suppose in doing so, the Jewish people would have resembled the Egyptians more and more. And I guess we would have come out of Egypt with Egyptian arts and you know, some of the cultural baggage and accessories that the Egyptians that we left behind. And the Ishbitzer says this is why when we eat the Korban Pesach, we're not allowed to break the bones of the Korban Pesach. It says ve'etzem lo yisishberu boy, we're not allowed to suck the marrow out of the bones of the Paschal lamb. Why? Because we didn't suck the marrow out of the Egyptians, and we left holy things behind, and we just it was there wasn't time. God says, you know, the Eden have suffered enough here, and you know, I'm taking them out of Egypt, even though there's still holy sparks in Egypt that could be raised, and there are things about Egypt that still could become Jewish, but the Eden have been here enough, and so it's time to go, and it's time for that great wheel to pass over the Egyptians. And so, because it's not time, it's not the fullness of time, it hasn't the wickedness, iniquity of the Egyptians hadn't ripened to the point where their great civilization had gone into eclipse and was now on the way down. And there was a there was a it was happening before the time, and so in that destruction, there's no divine joy. And what's happening here is that Yitzchak thinks that there's something about Jacob that, you know, we have this talent as Jewish people that we can raise the sparks, and it doesn't matter where we go in the world, we have this ability to refine the cultural value, whatever that cultural value is, whichever nation that we are among. And bring out the desire that's inside it, the cheshek, which you said that the desire is the holiness inside the thing. Once it gets acted out by the goyim, it's no great shakes, but the desire inside every cultural icon, every story, every fairy tale, every, you know, every fashion, everything has inside it a desire, right? And that desire is the divine spark. And Isaac thinks that Jacob is gonna spend the entirety of history refining those sparks. And it doesn't matter where Esau goes, Jacob will follow. And then he discovers that, in fact, no, that's not the case. That Jacob is only going to do what there is time to do. And the truth is that Esau has infinite greatness. It's true. The greatness that Isaac sees in his son Esau is the Chochma Ilo'o. Our Torah is only the unripe version of the supernal Chochma. And Esau is connected there to the supernal Chochma. We talked about many times before that some of the things that come out of Esau, like Rome, and then out of Rome comes Nero, and out of Nero comes Reb Meir, and the Stam Mishnah, that there's some things about the Torah that we have that come directly from that Chochmei Elohim, that don't come through Moshe, that comes, you know, from the other direction, because it can only come from that place. And that's the greatness of the Jewish people, that we're able to take something out of that most evil place and turn it into something really holy and sacred and joyous. But once Yaakov takes those brachos from Esav, and Esav is now not going to be shown to be the essential middle of the narrative, that in fact Yaakov is the chelik, is the portion of God, and this is something that Yitzhak did not know. At that point, Esau's fate is sealed, that he is not going to be mevura, he is not going to be shown in the past as having been the chosen one, and his derech, his way of life, is nothing but a way of life. It's not a way of worshiping God. It's nothing to do with celebrating the divine. It's just, it is what it is. In a sense, you know, when this unfolding drama happens, it becomes clear that Yaakov is not going to save Esav, and Esav is going to die. And that in the future, you know, we're going to the tzion that we talked about last week, that the Torah mitzvahs that we do, which are cloaked in the divine, that the, really when I'm wrapping myself in my talis, I'm really wrapping myself in God, that the talis is a tzion, is a sign, a symbol of some of the life force, and that when that becomes revealed, then Esav will be shown to be less and less. This was a little bit like Yaakov killing Esav, even by accident. It's the reason for having to go into exile, that the Medrash Tanchuma opens with, that you know, teach us, Rebbe, what happens if somebody kills somebody by accident. In a sense, the unfolding of this narrative is the death of Esav. And so Yaakov has to go into Golis. Then we find he goes Vayivka Bamokoim. He reaches this place, which we told is the place, the Mokoim HaMikdash. It's the place where the temple is going to be. And he falls asleep there and he has a dream. The Medrash says, Vayivka Bamokoim, and he reaches the place. What place is this? This is the place of the Beis Hamikdash. Vayivka Bamokoim, Reb Huna Mishne B'Ami. Why it says, why do we call God Mokoim? Mipnei Ma Machane Shmoi Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu VeKorim Oisem Mokoim. Why is God called Mokoim? Shehu Mekoima Shel Oilam VeEin Oilam Mekoima. He is the place of the world, and the world is not his place. Meaning that God encompasses the world, but the world really does not encompass God. And Reb Aber Reb Yudon says it's like a gibor. Imagine you've got this warrior Shehu Raichev al Hasus. He's, you've got a warrior sitting on a horse. V'kelav mishupom elech velech. And his accoutrements are all, you know, they're hanging front and back. Hasus tfele le Raichev. The horse is secondary to the rider. V'eino Raichev tfele le sus. And the rider is not secondary to the horse. So what does this mean? And what does this have to do with Mokim? You know, if you imagine medieval horse and rider, you know, with those great war horses that had like curtains around them, right? Who today, you know, imagine a horse wearing curtains. Anyway, so you got this, the horse wearing armor, and on it is sitting a man in armor. So the man's got, you know, breastplate and greaves and all these, all this iron, right? And he's got a lance, and he's got a helmet, and the helmet's got a face, a visor, and he's got gauntlets and gloves and the whole thing, right? So when you look at the, well, first of all, you can't see the man. You don't see the warrior. All you see is this great beast, this huge horse, and on it is this iron mannequin, and inside there's a person, and then you see the horse charging to war. So it's very easy to imagine that the horse is in charge. But we know that in fact it's not the case, that the little puny, you know, flesh and blood person inside all that iron is in fact carrying the armor. The armor is not carrying the person, the person is carrying the armor. And the person is riding the horse and telling the horse what to do, not the other way around. So the Medrash is saying that the Ribbono Shel Olam is in charge of the world, even though we look at the world and we see the midos, we see the way the world is being run. You have another way would be, see, if you look at the history of the world and you look at the Jewish people, it's, you know, who is it right to say that the Jewish people are running the world? There's the great, there's China, there's the East, there's India, there's Africa, there's Australia, there's the Americas, where Eden never were. And it's hard to say that monotheism is what led, you know, these civilizations to rise and fall and rise again. And you know, what's the meaning of Jewish history inside this? It just looks like the world, you know, the world is going on its journey, and the Jews are, you know, being carried along in that journey. And the Medrash is saying, Vayifka b'mokoyim, that Yaakov Avinu is feeling really bad. He's feeling like, you know, he's done the wrong thing. He doesn't feel at home in Beersheba. His father said to him, you know, you better leave. His mother said to him, you know, your brother wants to kill you. And Yaakov Avinu himself, you know, says, I don't really have a place in my father's house now. I'm not even going to be in the Holy Land anymore. I'm going to have to go outside. And the ultimate exile, the ultimate gulus, is that he now feels exiled within himself. Because what is it? What's Yaakov's avoida? What is it that Jacob does that makes him who he is? Avraham, he's the one who becomes aware of God in the world, and his job is to make everybody aware that God is in the world, which he's done successfully. Isaac is the one who feels God inside himself and can feel the Shekhin inside himself, and his job is to reveal to the world, to everybody in the world, that it's an inside job. that if you want, you can become aware and you can interact with the God inside you. Having done that, what is left for Yaakov? What is Yaakov's thing? Yaakov is, it's not about either of the two things that his Zayda or his father did, right? Completely different. Yaakov is about action. Yaakov says, you know what? You don't have to do what my Zayda did. What was it that Avram said, you know, everything that I do, I'm going to trust God. And, you know, if I think this is the right thing to do, I'm going to be kind to this person. I'm going to take this person under my wing. I'm going to teach this person that God exists. He didn't say to himself, you know, maybe I shouldn't. Maybe this person shouldn't know the Torah. Maybe this person is going to take what I teach him and use it for... No, Avraham Avinu trusts that God is going to make everything good. Yitzhak is the opposite, right? Yitzhak says, I'm only going to do exactly what I need to do, because he feels the Shekhinah inside him and he knows what is demanded of him, and so he does what he's supposed to do, even if that means I'm going to bless Esau with all the blessings of Olam Haba, the world to come, and so forth, even knowing that he's wicked. But hey, I need to do what I need to do. My job is not to decide on what to do, but to do what I feel I'm supposed to do. And these two actions, that of Avraham and Yitzhak, you know, Avraham doing everything as an act of faith, and Isaac doing everything as an act of justice or the law, obedience, you know, this comes out of their philosophy, right? Avraham sees God everywhere in the world, so what could go wrong, right? Isaac sees God inside, and like, what could I do right? Yaakov says, I'm not going to do anything ever that's going to require Berurin afterwards, that's going to require some kind of narration of a story in order to make it right. I'm going to do everything right. In other words, I'm never going to lift my hand or my leg to do anything based on what I think should be done. I'm going to wait for God to show me what to do before I do anything. And this is why God calls Jacob God. Vayikra Elikim Kael Oila. God calls Jacob God, El. And what does it mean that God calls a human God? You know, the difference between a human and God is that this narrative that we were talking about, that a human narrative, you do one thing and then God can make it turn out to be something quite different, like the story of Yehuda Tama, right? So this is the planting of the seed of Mashiach. Is that what Yehuda meant? No, it's what God meant. You know, so God can take the human act and turn it into something quite other, the opposite. The God act is, it's not like that, right? There's no coming afterwards and some God makes it right. Yeah? Yaakov Avinu, his acts are God acts in the sense that, as he says later in Parshas Vayechi, when he's talking to Yosef, he says, my parents who walked before God, God, who is my shepherd from the beginning. And he thinks, Yaakov thinks, that his ancestors are great because they walk before God. You know, they each have their derech, their way of worshipping, as we said, Avraham and Yitzchak. But Jacob says, I can't do that. You know, I trust God to tell me what to do. I'm just a sheep. You know, God, who's my shepherd since I was, whatever I've done because God told me explicitly this is the next thing to do. And Yaakov thinks that makes me the lesser. But in fact, this is the greatest of all the things that we can do in life, is not like Avraham and not like Yitzhak, but like Yaakov, to know the act that I'm about to, never mind what my kavana is, and never mind what my philosophy is, never mind, you know, whether I'm into chesed like Avram or gevura like Yitzhak, how am I acting? And, you know, a person might think, that the mind, like Avraham was the greatest philosopher, unquestionably the greatest philosopher. And Yitzhak's unquestionably the greatest tzaddik with the biggest heart to lie there on the Mizbeach. Yaakov, he doesn't engage his mind or his heart, right? It's about action. But you know something? You can raise your hands above your heart, above your head. There's something about the Yaakov Avinu's actions which go above the heart and above the head, which means that they touch something which is the Most High. And this is Vayivka b'mokoyim. Yaakov feels so bad that he's ruining things, and he's alienated. And God nigla olav. And we were saying here in the Tanchuma, Yaakov Avinu golol l'Choron. Yaakov Avinu is exiled to Choron, running away. God sees him, nigla olav. I want to say that the Medrash is punning on the word golos, on the word exile. That niglo and goilo, that they're connected here. That God shows Yaakov that in doing what you do, before the creation of the world, if we can imagine the revelation, it's really pure revelation. Everything is revealed, the divine desire is revealed. And then, as creation, unfolds, things become hidden. Avraham reveals that God is still in the world. God didn't go anywhere else, and God is right here. And that was the whole avodah of Avraham. Yitzhak, he reveals not that God is in the world, that his father already did, but that God is inside you, that God is inside me, that never disappeared. All I have to do is just open my inner eye, okay? Yaakov, what's his revelation? The revelation that the act is still connected to the divine, that the things we do are still the divine acts, and that nothing requires clarification, nothing requires that the narrative be rewritten and that God pull that thread and re-knit the unraveled cloak, that the thing was the divine decree and the divine desire right from the beginning, that the act was the divine act. That was something that Yaakov Avinu was able to show us, to show the world. In doing so, he touches a place which is higher than that of Avraham and Yitzchak. That he touches that place where, if we could imagine the world before creation, the idea of the world, in which the whole narrative of the world is laid out in a non-time bound schedule, that the unfolding of events is that Rotzon HaPoshet that we talked about, that simple desire of God to be and to be the way, I wanted to say, to be known, to know and to be known. When we talked about the Rotzon HaPoshet, when we were learning Sefer Yetzirah, the covenant, the bris of rachamim, of compassion, that's what it's all about. And our narrative, is full of darkness because we're just so confused. But really, Yaakov Avinu is touching that place before the revelation of the darkness, and he's in touch with that, with the oneness. And so the Medrash says, Vayivka b'mokoyim, that he reaches that place, and then what happens? All the stones become one. Yaakov Avinu is shown that in fact he is the mokoyim, he is the place, and not that God is the place. Yes, God is the mokoyim, because he's the mekoma shel olam, not that he needs space. And the mokom hamigdash, this place where the temple is going to be, is also hamokom, this very special place, because it's not really in space. You know, you could measure the way the Aron HaKodesh, the Holy Ark, was in, and you know, there was 10 cubits on either side of it, even though it itself took up a cubit and a half, because it didn't take up any space. It was a space outside space. And Yaakov Avinu is that space of the world that is outside space. God says to him, you are me. Because the face of Yaakov is chokuk and kiseh hakovot. The face of Jacob is carved onto the throne of glory. And God is saying to Yaakov, you can stop worrying about the things you've done, because nothing requires birur. Nothing is going to require clarification. There is no narrative that has to happen for me to unravel and re-knit in order to make what you've done turn out right. Everything is the right thing, and you are quite right. Everything that you've done is because I have told you to do it, and I've shown you what to do. And that is the meaning of the life of Yaakov. And it's true that nothing is going to become visible to the world until he comes back from Choran, until after he's married Rachel and Leah, and he's gone through that story. Then he comes back and it becomes apparent to everybody else. But here, at this point in history, God says to him, it's all one. There is no there's no duality. There's only one stone. There's one place. There's one God. There's one Yaakov. There's one Jewish people. There's one narrative. Everything is the way it's supposed to be.